Welcome to Talking Beats. I hope you'll subscribe and give us a 5-star review on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere you get your podcasts. If you like the show, please consider supporting us at patreon.com/talkingbeats. That's patreon.com/talkingbeats. We believe now more than ever in providing a platform for individuality, free thought, and a diverse range of views. By supporting the show this way, you'll get early access to episodes, bonus episodes, and much more. And remember, the conversation is always active at Talking Beats Podcast on social media. On today's program, actress, singer, songwriter, and television personality, Miss Peppermint, the first trans woman to appear on RuPaul's Drag Race. She's also had leading roles on Broadway, in addition to appearing on Saturday Night Live and The Daily Show. She's out with a new album now. We're here to dig into it, dig into the emotions behind it, and the complex world of a black trans woman living a very public life. Miss Peppermint, welcome.
Hello, Daniel. Thank you very much for having me to Talking Beats.
Is it music? Is it acting? Is it being on stage? Is it the lights? Is it the feeling, the energy of the audience? What does it for you? What keeps you going?
I would have to say all of the above at different times. Because if it was just one thing, it probably would get boring, right? And so it's all of those things. Just when I'm over it with, I fall in love with the lights, and then I'm doing a, of course, now I miss the lights, the theater lights. But when there was a time when we were doing theater, falling in love with the lights and everything on the stage, and then you have Tech Week, and then you're like, you could never see another stage light again for all you cared. And then there's the audience that is adoring and can be lovely, and sometimes the audience is, you know, every once in a while, the energy with the audience isn't quite connecting with you. And then, you know, there's something else that you can always be grateful for. I think that the life of an entertainer, I think sometimes to our demise, means that we are willing to accept many conditions.
I have played some cello concerts, some pretty weird places, that's for sure, and some strange backstage situations. But usually all of that is assuaged when you go on stage and you think yourself,
oh, absolutely,
oh, it's all worth it. The hellish whatever 2 hours before, it's all melting away now that I'm on stage and doing what I'm here to do.
Yeah, the path to the stage is always the most horrid for me, but the stage is the most comfortable place ever, right?
So
enjoy it.
So talk about that idea, that feeling of joy that you get. You've been on, I mean, you were a cheerleader in high school, and so you've been sort of doing, mm-hmm. you know, doing the act of, you know, being on stage, getting that hopefully adoring audience. When as a kid did you think to yourself, God, this is really the thing that makes me most happy?
I'd say it was probably before I had an active audience, actually. I mean, even in high school, the audience is kind of there by, you know, like they're at least there because they know that they're going to see something. But, you know, I think my first few times I realized, some of the earliest times I realized that performing was what I wanted to do was probably when I was forcing people to participate in my little fantasy. obviously, children usually have the upper hand when they feel emboldened, when they have a captive audience in their family at, you know, holiday time. But then, you know, there have been also times, I've told a story a few times before where I don't know why, well, I know what my fascination was with The Wizard of Oz. That's no surprise.
What was
but
it?
It was everything. It was the fantasy. It was probably the escape. But more than that, it was the colors. I think I remember being so, like, just beside myself that something could go from black and white to color. I had seen as a kid black and white, obviously many black and white programs, and obviously ones in color. But I had never the thought. For some reason, I just thought that those were two different things, and that one meant one was old and one was newer. Like, that's kind of what I associated. And then Wizard of Oz, the film, the colorized version of the film, you know, obviously goes into color when Dorothy gets to Oz, and that just fascinated me, and it made it feel like everything was even more colorful than real life. And so, I remember getting all the kids in the neighborhood who just wanted to play, you know, tag or dodgeball or whatever we were playing. And I remember like marching them up into my, forcing everyone up into my mom's, into my apartment. Then I would go back into my mom's closet, which was the theater closet, according to me, and take out all the clothes that I thought, I mean, everything fit the kids because it was my mom's. And I would bring all the clothes out, and whatever was the closest to a costume, a black dress for the witch, some dungarees for the scarecrow, whatever. And I would put, you know, everybody dressed up. And then I cut out yellow construction paper squares and laid them through my whole apartment. And that was my first time, like, feeling like I was producing something. And then, of course, we just sat and watched Wizard of Oz, because that's what else we're going to do.
Well, so fast forward to years later, and you're on a real stage with real costumes. You have, you know, big lights and real producers and dressing rooms and the whole thing. What is the act of, you know, preparing a show, going through it? Talk about the communal aspect when you're not at it alone, but you're, you know, sort of with like me with the violins and the oboes and everybody, you know, we're sort of working together to bring a bigger goal to fruition.
I think being a musician, I'm certainly a singer, but I think being a musician in general, an instrumentalist, really does kind of highlight that, because, and I don't really know, you would know far more than I would. As a matter of fact, what I'm about to say, I'm sure, is quite wrong. Oh, let me put my phone on silent.
That was great timing. That was a great sound effect.
Wasn't it? But what I remember, because I also was in the orchestra and in the band.
What'd you play?
I played cello. Then I switched to viola, and I played that until there was no, when I was growing up, you could choose orchestra or band. And so I chose orchestra. And then after a certain point, there was just never an orchestra. Like after like sixth grade or seventh grade, then orchestra was gone forever. There was no way I could get orchestra. I would have to just take individual lessons. And that was no fun, because the best part for me about playing a viola was being able to sit next to all of the other stringed instruments and hear what we created. It just, I mean, unless you're a violin, nobody was writing any melody parts for sixth grade music, you know? And so I was like, what? I can't do this. This is stupid to do alone. So then I switched over to band and I played percussion, because I wasn't trying to learn a wind instrument. And so I played percussion. I play the bells. I don't know why those things were separate. Like, why there was, like, I don't, anyway, that's a separate story. But I remember as when I was in orchestra and when I was playing the bells in band, that notion of playing a part, playing your part that alone didn't sound like much. but then together, you know, you created this beautiful piece. And I remember feeling very proud about the music that we would have at our concerts, at our holiday concerts. And the family would be so happy. And they'd be like, you sounded so great. And I knew, I was like, you really didn't hear me, because I was playing, like, you know, the viola in the back. Like, it was just part of the thing. But
yeah, but
they were so impressed. And I remember, like, feeling happy that I was able to contribute. And so to answer your question, I think that actually added a lot to my my approach to theater anyway. I really enjoy ensemble pieces of work, bodies of work. I'm very fascinated by like the company. And I've always been really fascinated. I mean, I've always enjoyed the show, but I'm so fascinated in how things work and who's doing what behind the scenes. And maybe that just means I'm destined to be a producer. But I really enjoy being able to build a camaraderie with the cast, whomever that is or whatever we're working on, so that it just feels as tight and as family-like as possible. Now, I'm sure there's egos even in a professional orchestra.
Exactly.
Yeah, even. But it was because of that like initial experience that I had that was ego-free. Although I was always very jealous of the violins because they were like always front and center. But
with the big tunes, the violins with playing.
Yeah, with the big tunes. Yeah. They instantly, their part was like the part that everybody recognized.
Exactly. Exactly.
Mine was rah, 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 rah. And I was like, okay.
they get all the glory. And I always, there's, you know, if you look at the cello or bass part for a Mozart symphony, it's just, you know, simple quarter notes and eighth notes, and it's such a sparse part. But then you put it together,
yeah,
and it's like, oh my,
and it's so magic. Beautiful. It's necessary, and that's the thing that I was, not to go off on a tangent about stringed instruments.
No, go off.
But
please.
I always thought that, I mean, like you said, the violinists get this, they get all the glory, and no one even knew what a viola was. I didn't even know what a viola was until I started playing it. And the only reason I started playing it is because we were, we rented my instrument, and I guess we just didn't have enough money to buy one or something. And I think initially when I started playing, it's what was laying around in the back at the school from the orchestra teacher. So I guess they'd had some donated instruments or something. And I wanted to play violin, but they didn't have any violins. And my arms were too long for the smaller violin that they did have. So I played the viola, which is obviously bigger. And no one, but when I would tell people what I play, they'd be like, what? What is that? And then eventually I was like, it's like a small cello.
Exactly. It's funny about the long arms. I know people who were sort of, you know, decent violinists, and then they switched to viola. I'm thinking of a friend of mine. She's probably like 6 feet tall, and she was a good violinist, but she switched to viola, and suddenly she was just unbelievable instantly on the viola. Yeah. Just that the difference in the physicality just fit her.
It's a different, you, it's a, it's built for different people. Yeah.
Yeah. So okay, so now we all know you played cello and viola. How many people knew that before you're telling me right now?
I mean, people who I don't really talk about it that often, because I don't have that many people to talk about it with. But I mean, if it ever comes up about playing an instrument, I would mention it. Yeah, I've mentioned it a few times.
So you're not breaking any news with that, but a few more people.
No, not breaking news. People who remember me from the orchestra probably know.
So yeah, as a bitter, jealous violist in the back who
yeah,
talk about what's been giving you that personal optimism and that will to get up and keep doing music. You're making new music videos, new songs, you know. So I think a lot of people these days are just looking for that one or two things that they can fall back on, you know. And for a lot of people, it is music. You know, when I take out my cello, I'm not playing concerts right now. When I take out the cello, you know, I think to myself, yeah, this is, you know, everything is okay right now, you know.
It's a myriad of things, right? Like, I do find joy in the things that have always brought me joy, just not even as a performer necessarily, just watching, my hobby is watching horror movies. And so I love to do that. And I watch them all the time, all year long, not just in the fall. And throughout the quarantine, you know, I've done a lot of the normal things, like keeping it, obviously doing Zooms and keeping in touch with family, you know, members and everything, and re sort of connecting with people that I hadn't even talked to in years. But I was really hard at work on creating music, and that's been the biggest catharsis for me, because I was, this album that I'm about to release is about, it's very personal. It's probably my most personal music yet.
Hanging around with singers, it usually ends up being opera singers, sort of more, I don't know, joyful or more, I think they're more dramatic than instrumental players.
I mean, I think if we're talking about classical singers, I think that's probably very true. But I would have to say, like pop singers and, you know, the like are probably more contemporary styles are probably, I'd say that dramatic, that drama probably is more read as narcissism, I would imagine. I'm not calling myself a narcissist. I'm just saying, I don't know if people, you know, I don't know. Something seems endearing and entertaining when we describe it as dramatic.
That's too positive of a word to use for some vocalists.
Yes.
So speaking about drama, so if we look at the word drama, we can create it in so many ways. We can create it out of nothing. We can create it out of real life. We can invent it, you know, with fiction. Often it's taken from real life and put onto the page. What is it with you and your songs? You know, all good songs need some sense of drama, need an mm-hmm. arc, need some real emotion. So you mentioned before how this album has the most personal quality from your life, from your heart, put into music. Talk about that translation process.
It's not as linear as I would have liked to talk about it, you know. And, you know, conversationally, it would be great if it was very linear. The album is a collaboration with a couple of different writers that I have worked with before, that I'm very close with. And that I love very much. And they know me really well. And they both have their own processes. And so each song, depending on where it sat in my brain and in my heart, and you know, depending on who I was working with, had a different sort of pathway to the album, to the finished product of the album. But basically, you know, I had these experiences. These are all of the songs are inspired by very surface life experiences that live very much on the surface. These are experiences with matters of the heart. and as a trans woman, as a queer person, I think in general, although love is universal and love and sex are universal, the way that we express and experience, the way that we court, the way that we, as meaning queer people generally, experience the whole beginning, middle, and end of a relationship can be different, not only as individuals, but then also as queer people. Because we weren't really, many of us, especially if you grew up in the United States or in Western culture and are adults, we're not socialized with a queer sensibility in mind. And so we had to pull all of our cues from works of art, songs, music, theater, movies that weren't written about us or for us at all. And a certain, most of our parents and family members weren't teaching us, you know, how to be a good lesbian or whatever. And so, you know, it's the school of hard knocks is particularly hard. The knocks are particularly hard, I think, for in the beginning of one's journey as an LGBT person when it comes to love. And so I say all that to say that a lot of my trans friends, my circle of friends, we sit around and we talk about some of these things that are just commonplace for us. But when I talk to other people, they're like, you really have to go through that? And it's just so interesting to me that on something that should be so universal and approachable, there's still these flavors and these things that a lot of people have never experienced. And so I wanted to be able to bring all that to my music. And the song that's the heart of the album, of the whole project, which is also holds the title, A Girl Like Me, it was a really emotional song to write because it talks not only about my breakup and my experience, and it also talks about how I would like to be treated and how other girlfriends and people that I talk to who are trans would like to be treated versus how we a lot of times are treated. And then it also talks about the violence that trans women of color specifically endure sometimes. You know, the murder rate is very high. And not to be a drag or talk so seriously, but these are all the things that went into the building of that song and the rest of the album. And so that song in particular, I talked to my co-writer Adam Joseph on that, and I was sitting right here on my couch. I was actually laying on my couch, and we were taking my experiences and jotting them down, and then making little parts that rhyme. And we knew that we wanted this song to be a ballad. So we kind of started on the piano and got a few key, notes together and kind of plunked out a melody and gave it some bones. And then we went ahead and just started to build in lyrics one by one. And, by the time we had the chorus and I think the second verse done, we were in tears. Like, I was silent. Like, we sang it, and then I was silent, and he was silent and afterwards. And I was like, "Are you okay?" He's like, "Yeah, I'm crying." And I was like, "Me too." Mm. And that's how I knew that that was a special one.
Put a finer point on you have all these experiences, and you have all these emotions you're swirling, and the thing about music is that somehow all of these crazy heightened emotions need to be put in a way that everybody can understand. So mm-hmm. So they have to be sort of sorted through. So you're lying there on the couch, he's there taking notes. I'm not a composer, but I know enough to know that it's sort of like a distillation process. You have mm-hmm. to take all of this and somehow sort it out in a way that has that effect, not just on you, but on the listener too. That's ultimately, I think, what songwriting's about, sort of mm-hmm. distilling what you have mm-hmm. in a way that's meaningful for more people than just you, but it has to be sincere. Mm-hmm. So what is that note-taking process? Like, he sits at the piano, he plays a chord. Get into the nitty-gritty of how the songs come about.
Well, I mean, they're often very different. But for instance, with that song, we wanted to choose the temperature of the song first. And we said, okay, we want something that kind of is, it has leaves space and for lack of better words, feel sad. That wasn't our goal, but something that was not just like fun and light beat and upbeat and lighthearted. We wanted something that was reverent and would be able to carry the weight of the subject matter and the lyrics. And so we wanted to make a bed of really nice notes. And so he did. It's the song has a lot of arpeggios in it, which are just for people who I'm sure your listeners probably know what an arpeggio is. But just descending music notes, just going up and down. And so that's the main kind of the through line and the kind of the heartbeat of the song. Or I'll say the blood of the song. And we just kind of sat and listened to the beat, it's mostly just piano. Later on we added in other instruments, but we set up the music first. Once we kind of knew the feeling of the song, we set up the music and we're like, what about this? What about that? And so that's one way that Adam particularly likes to work is to have something that almost feels like 50% done music before we start writing any lyrics. Once we know the subject matter and the tempo of the song, is it a slow song? Is it a fast song? Great. That it's a love song that's slow. Great. Let's make slow music for that you can write love words to. And so that's what we did. And then after that, we listened to it and started to, we had my subject. We knew what it was about. We knew the next thing I think that we probably figured out was the title or the chorus. Like, what is the, what's the takeaway? What's the chorus? What's the, if you can only have one sentence in this song, what is it? A Girl Like Me. There it is. And so then we knew that that was what we would always come back to, which ends up being the chorus. And so with Adam, the process is usually building the chorus first. And, you know, figuring out what is, I mean, I don't have the notes in front of me, and it, we wrote, believe it or not, once we started going, it was like a spigot or a faucet, you turn it on. And then we just, it, for this song, it all just came out. It was very emotional. It was very, we were very connected. And so A Girl Like Me, and I just basically listed all of the things that a girl like me goes through, a girl like me with dating, the, you know, that our partners don't understand us. We're one group where, you know, our partners are killing us. Literally, there's, you know, been near 30 something trans women of color that were murdered this year violently. And almost all of them were by intimate partners, their boyfriends, people they were, their intimate partners.
What is that about? You know, we read it, we see a headline, you know, but then again, there's so many headlines, it's difficult to keep track. But we see a headline, trans woman of color murder. What is with this murder rate by as you just said, people who are, what, the partner? What is going on?
It's the symptom of, we are at the gutter end of what society participates in. And what I mean by that is, the trans murder rate being so sad, trans women being killed is by their partners, is kind of, you can correlate that with almost the suicide rate. You hear about LGBT people. I'm sure that, you know, we've heard statistics about gay teens and LGBT people, teenagers, the suicide rate being very high amongst gay teenagers, LGBTQ teenagers, and youth. It's not because they're so sad that they are gay. It's that they live in a world that makes it difficult for them to be gay and proud. And all of the signals, you know, point them in a direction that many of those people feel like it would be a better choice to, you know, to try to harm themselves. It's not that they think that they should be harmed because they are gay. It's that the world that they're in, the surroundings that they're in, make it difficult. And that's the same thing with the murder rate for trans women, but it's not, in this case, these trans women are being murdered by their intimate partners. The intimate partners are not killing the trans women just because, for the most part, I mean, obviously I don't know all of them. I don't know any of them mostly. But you know, what we know is that these are intimate partners, and intimate partners are intimate with us because they like to be intimate with whoever they're intimate with. It's not that they are going around and just randomly killing people. These are people that they are emotionally and sexually connected with in some way. But the bigger piece is, they would rather kill that person than have their mother, their father, their cousin, their coworkers, other guys on the internet find out that that's who they're into. So when that is a factor, and there's a chance that they could be outed or exposed, it's internalized. It's not only internalized, it's internalized and external homophobia. And, you know, the men who are into trans women are chastised and ostracized for being gay, even though that's not what they are, unless they identify as gay. But that's, you know, most of the, and I've had conversations with the people that, well, obviously I've had conversations with my boyfriends, my ex-boyfriends, they all identify as straight, and their attraction is, in my case, their attraction is to women. Tall women, short women, black women, white women, trans women, cisgender women, just women. But society makes it so that we will make fun of you if you are attracted to a trans woman. And so a lot of these guys can't handle that because, like I said, none of us grew up in a world where we learned how to treat a trans woman, how to be a partner to a trans woman. Instead of working through those emotions, a lot of these guys just end up snapping. And then there's something called the trans panic defense, where it was basically legal to kill a trans woman as long as you said, oh, I didn't know she was trans. This is someone that you've been having sex with for 4 months and you didn't know she was trans. On Jerry Springer, we've seen those guys. Oh, we've been having sex for years. Oh, you're trans? Let me pick up a chair and hit you. The reaction on Jerry Springer, and what is the reaction of the audience? They cheer and they holler and they scream and they want the guy to beat, they literally want the guy to beat the woman who professes her love to him. So that's the dynamic. A lot of people, when they see these articles in the newspaper and the headlines, are like, oh, I have no idea. Yes, you do. When you see a trans woman, what is your reaction? When you see someone who loves a trans woman, how do you treat that person? What do you make fun of them? Do you question them? I'm not saying you, Daniel. I'm just saying in general. And so I think that's what really plays into all of that. Of course, there's definitely other factors at play, I'm sure. But it's, you know, I think, you know, when we're talking about socioeconomic status and we're talking, a lot of these murders are of trans women of color. Many of these trans women are in a situation, the only job that they can hold, that they can decide to get into, that will make them some money, enough money, but it's also the job with the least security. And I'm sure we know what that is. It's the oldest profession because it's legal in many states to fire someone for being trans now. And there are lots of states where many states where discrimination against trans people is legal, you know, and this administration that we're in is making that even easier. And so very long story short, these are some of the things that we have to deal with and consider when we're dating. Is this the kind of person that's going to want to kill me? I know that sounds dramatic, but it's something I have to consider. If I'm matching with this person who wants to come over and hook up or meet me or see me, but I have to really investigate, does his family know? What is his family going to say about him dating a trans woman? How will he react? Will he be violent? And these are things that are really difficult questions to ask and answer, because sometimes the answer isn't quite so obvious. And so those are some of the things that are always swirling through my head when I'm walking down the street. Am I safe? What's the reaction going to be? And so when we see trans women murdered, a lot of times it's just a disregard for us as humans, because whoever was involved in that, whoever knows about that murder, whoever was around, thought it would be better for us to be dead than for anyone to know that we knew them.
This is a lot to take in. I thank you for being so candid. So I think people will...
I'm so sorry to bring us to this. I knew you asked about how we write the song.
Not at all. The whole point is on this show, I like to use music as a way to dig deeper into people. And that's, mm-hmm. you know, oftentimes music is the avenue to do that. What do you see this album of music as offering other than just some good music?
Well, I mean, simply, I really would like to allow a bridge for people who aren't like me to understand people who are like me, and B, also a comfortable place to sit for people who are like me so that they can sit and enjoy some music that is about them, for them, about their experiences, you know, and they can take it in. I mean, music that, I guess the beauty behind sort of, you know, classical music and, you know, beautiful symphonies is that all we have to, we can take from it what we will. It's subjective, and we can hear the music and the notes and they speak to us. And sometimes they say the same thing. Sometimes they say different things, but there's no lyrics to really editorialize anything. And sometimes that's what we want, and sometimes we want to hear someone singing. And in music where there's lyrics and there's a vocalist, I think that in pop music, we've made a business of love. Like from the 50s on, we've really made an industry of love songs and really, you know, taking people's experiences and making a real industry of that. And when that happened, a lot of those people, those creative people, those queer people who were creating a lot of that music had to shroud their own experiences and sort of, you know, translate them into something that was just homogenized and relatable to everybody. So we would never really hear a gay person singing about their love of another man or a woman, whoever they're into. You know, we hear Ricky Martin, one of the biggest stars in the world at a time, singing about his girlfriend, which he never had. So, you know, it just, that's great. Love is universal. But what we desperately need in a time when there's a severe lack of understanding about who we are, we need ourselves to see ourselves, and we need other people to see us in a way that's not taboo, in a way that's not just us on Jerry Springer or in the news. We need to see us celebrated and experiencing joy. I was in this relationship. It was the best relationship that I'd ever been in up to that point. And I wanted to talk about it, and I want people to hear it. I wanted to make the record that I would have wanted to hear as a young trans girl.
What music are you listening to right now? When we get off this call, what are you going to go put on?
Let me see. It's called the internet. And what I mean that, I don't mean the literally the internet. It's a group called the internet. And I'm really digging them right now. Sort of kind of, it's R&B. It's like, it would have been in the neo-soul category in the early 2000s. I don't think that's a category anymore. I don't know if it is. Well, I quite literally was just listening to them today. I really do like older, like music from, I sort of live in the pool of music from my past. That's like, that's my beginning, middle, and end. And then every once in a while, I'll get out of the pool and go over to the sort of jacuzzi of new music. But it's very, I'm very selective with what I allow into my brain. And so I go back to the, I go back to the good old comfortable pool of the music that I think is classic. So I'm, who's on my playlist today? Prince, Jamiroquai, you know, a lot of these soul artists, Pearl Jam, like basically 90s alternative music, Smashing Pumpkins, not so much Nirvana, a little Guns N' Roses. But really what I'm into right now, especially since I'm in a sort of R&B state of mind, is, you know, the R&B and the soul greats and you know, even though Prince is not necessarily just soul or R&B, rock as well, and funk, those are the styles that are mostly up front and center for me right now.
I'll never forget when the symphony did, we did a Prince tribute concert, and the whole orchestra and the music, you know, it lent itself so well to the big strings. You're talking about the big violin parts before, and it was just the whole sound of I remember Purple Rain. I mean, it's his most famous song, but it may be, you know, sometimes things are the most famous and you wonder why, but other times they're the most famous and you say, yeah, I get why it's the most famous song. And with, you know, with Purple Rain, I would just remember playing that, and I could almost, I couldn't feel see it. The audience, but I could feel them, you know, crying. I could just feel it.
You know, it's, I mean, obviously losing someone like Prince was so devastating in the way that we did. But I have to say, I've done a few Prince songs, and one of the songs on this album is inspired by a Prince song, a B-side called The Morning Papers. And we Prince's music really, not only does it hold up well, I mean, I think that's a given, but it translates really well from genre to from style to style. I'm not surprised that an entire orchestra could play Prince's music. It's written so impeccably that you could take it. There's a million parts buried into Prince music. Whereas you take, I'm sorry, listeners, you take a Britney Spears song, it's you crack it open and it's just like some good beats and a couple of synths and there you have it. And Prince has some of these like parts that separately probably don't even sound like they would go together, but they just make this wonderful piece. I mean, I'm not lecturing about Prince. I'm by no means an expert, but
you're more than welcome to.
I've done a few Prince tunes in my day as well. I had a band that we used to play in the club, a nightclub here in New York, and we would play music, and oftentimes we would take a pop song or a popular music and then kind of reimagine it as a reggae song or something like that. And Prince was always the easiest to do because of how it was written musically.
Ms. Peppermint, I want to thank you for your emotions in the music and in the words. And I think people are going to get a lot out of this conversation. It's been a pleasure.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much, Daniel.
You've been listening to Talking Beats with Daniel Lalchuk. I hope you'll subscribe and leave a review on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere you get your podcasts. The original theme music for this program is by Ronald Markham. The content coordinator is Nathaniel Mosse. Doug Christian is the executive producer. I'm Daniel Lalchuk. See you next time.